welcome everyone. It's great to be up here, and I want to start by thanking someone who's not here right now, actually, Rav Aviva Richman, who is my long-standing chavruta. We're entering our 12th year of learning together this summer. She was the one who came up with the idea of this set of shiurim, and really in ways that are very direct and will be tangible tonight, in other ways that are a little bit less noticeable, has been really an inspiration in learning and thinking and living through all of this material. So I just want to give her that shout out. And I want to give a sense of where we're going. Over the last two sessions, we've talked about the body and what it means to be a body and to have a body. In as we relate to God and to one another and to ourselves. And today we're shifting to something that is closely related but in many, many ways fundamentally different, which is being human beings who have emotions and really trying to zero in on what the Torah kind of has to open up on this kind of situation we find ourselves in as human beings, that we have so many conflicting, strong, sometimes exciting and exhilarating, and sometimes like crushing and almost unbearable feelings. And I want to lay out three brief goals for where I kind of see us going tonight. And at the end, in the comments, you'll tell me kind of which, if any of these, I've made convincing, and your thoughts on them. The first is a kind of simple, almost encyclopedic claim, which is that when you look at Torah, you find a tremendous amount of emotional material. That we often think of it as norms and ethics, or we often think of it as about beliefs. And I wanted to say that there's just a lot of emotional material out there, and once you open your eyes to it, you'll find it. And especially in an area we're not going to look into tonight, which is the Tanakh. It's like God and human kind of emotion and action that spill out of that, or are maybe an essential part of that emotion, are really one of the central, if not the central, theme of the book. So that's claim number one. Claim number two, which is really kind of parallel to that, is that since these texts are so kind of emotionally rich and centered, it means that we, as we study them, should be emotionally centered and alive as well. That study is not, as David Hartman, for example, makes out to be, simply an act of kind of cognition, and of trying to understand something in the clearest way, but is also an emotionally engaging act. And that's the kind of study that I'll be trying to facilitate this evening. That's the second claim. But this is really a very powerful entry into the text, is through our own emotions. And the third claim is that we will find that having emotions and what those emotions are is a central aspect of what it means to be a person, is one of the central concerns for the Torah, our own emotional lives, our feelings, and kind of how we see ourselves, how we feel in the world, is one of the main things that is a concern of ours and, in the eyes of the Torah, also of God's. And that claim is kind of the biggest claim, and I think it will, if I can make it, will offer some really new windows into areas of interpersonal life, and especially of belief, that we'll get to. So that's where we're headed. The way I want to start is by just doing a mode of what we sometimes call spiritual chavruta, the chance to actually kind of think through and feel through some of these emotions. And the reason I want to do this is because kind of behind all of this is a basic question, which I want you all to have in your minds as we read through these texts. That there are basically two kind of clear ways to think about the place of emotions in human life. The first is that the idea that we're basically thinking, doing beings who unfortunately have this kind of like chaotic inner life that we have to more or less keep under wraps so that we can go around paying attention to other people, carrying out our obligations, being focused and clear, and not get too caught up in the tempest that's going on inside of us, in the same way that we might try to kind of say navigate the weather. We shouldn't attach too much significance to the fact that we live in a world of weather. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that we live in a that our emotions are essentially a part of our thinking. That when we feel something strongly, when we feel anger at someone, that's likely because we believe a set of things about them. For example, that they have done something bad to us or to someone we care about, that it's significantly bad, it's not kind of trivial and unimportant, that they did it intentionally, and that they don't seem to care or have tried to make up for it. And the reason that I lay out all those beliefs is in my experience, and I think in many people's, when one or more of those beliefs change, the anger also goes away. Right? If you find out that someone didn't understand what they were doing, or they actually have tried to make amends for it, the emotion of anger may not totally disappear, but it transforms in a basic way. Now, those two are very, very different ways of kind of approaching one's emotions, and there's probably some truth to both of them. And so the way I want to start off is by an opportunity to pair up with someone else and share a story of something, of a moment when you kind of had a strong encounter with your own emotions and something you learned from that. And I'm going to give an example of what I mean by that. When I was living in Israel, the beginning of my second year in yeshiva on Sukkot, my father called me and told me that my grandmother had passed away. And in the kind of about 36-hour span between that phone call and being able to get on a plane to go back to America, I remember this incredible feeling, which I've really never had to this extent, of sluggishness and of disengagement and of not really caring about any of the things that were happening around me there, feeling like I was totally out of place and listless. And a whole set of things that if I were to have those feelings in any other context would kind of clearly be negative feelings, right? They're the kinds of things that we don't want to feel when we wake up in the morning, when we're in the middle of a conversation, when we're living our normal lives. And as soon as I got on the plane, actually even before I got on the plane, I remember this when I checked into security, I started to have this feeling of kind of suddenly being pointed in the right direction, this feeling of kind of my internal compass having shifted towards the point where I wanted to be, and that feeling building and building and building until I eventually made my connecting flights and saw my family, and especially my grandfather. And what I feel like I learned from that engagement is really that the emotions I was feeling of kind of boredom and of being out of place were the most accurate things that could have possibly been said to describe my position at that moment, that I really was not in the place where I needed to be, where I most wanted to be, where the most important things in my life and for the people who were most important to me were happening. And that's the kind of moment I'm thinking about as an engagement. And that moment has taken me, you know, kind of a few years in some ways to think through and work through. And there are a whole different set of emotions you can have here. I mean, there are moments of joy and of excitement. I imagine people around the room are having a whole bunch of different things. And so what I want to ask you to do is pair off and take 6 minutes, 3 minutes a person, and try to tell a story in the vein of what I just did. And if you're the person who's listening, really kind of listen and try to get inside the emotional world of the person who's speaking. So if it's someone you don't know who you're talking with, please introduce yourselves. And I will give you time at 3 minutes to switch. So go to it. Great. So what we're going to do, this talk tonight is divided basically into two sections. The first on anger and fear, the second on joy and love. And each is based really primarily on one source. Raise your hand if you don't have a copy of the source sheet. Oh, right up here. Are there some extras? Molly, could you help with, there's some extras right behind you. And what I want to do for each part, we'll kind of read through the main sources and then take a few questions and comments. So if someone would be so brave as to read these first three paragraphs, these are an excerpt from Martha Nussbaum, who's a contemporary philosopher at the University of Chicago. She's written kind of two seminal books on this topic, and the first records three stories that she heard from the officers at West Point after delivering a lecture in the philosophy department there. And there are kind of three different windows into anger in public life, and they're really, here they're all happened in military circumstances, which will be very different from any Jewish source we'll read for fairly obvious reasons, but they still offer some useful windows. And so who would like to read? Sarah, go for it.
large black officer, walking into the camp and seeing what was there to be seen. This man began to curse, shouting at the top of his voice. As the child Wiseau watched, he went on shouting and cursing for a very long time. And the child Wiseau thought, watching him, now he manages to come back. Now, with that anger, humanity comes back.
This is one army, three stories separated by about 50 years and three totally different images of anger. And what Nussbaum makes of these is that anger really kind of operates between two poles. In Vietnam here, anger is an opportunity not just to harm other people, but to actually let down all of the guards we have against harming other people and actually to enjoy it. Right? It's the most dangerous possible mode for a human being, especially one with a weapon to be in. And at the other end, for Elie Wiesel, anger is maybe the only reaction we can have to the desecration of the most sacred things in the world, and particularly of human life. And then, in the middle somewhere, is General Schwarzkopf, and this kind of amazing moment where what happens, and what Nussbaum is so good at pointing out, is that Schwarzkopf's anger, which is something like the American officer walking into the death camp, starts to turn into a mode of dehumanization of others and an invitation for people to join him in that. And it's an image of how fluid all three of these things are and how they move back and forth. And now what Nussbaum doesn't point out, but I really want us to dwell on for a moment, is the ways in which the reactions of the people who are the objects or maybe the witnesses to these angers are so different, right? There's the, you can imagine the terror of the members of this village in Vietnam. The anger, that, on the one hand, that's number one. Number two is the anger that the American citizens are supposed to feel watching their general describe the horrors that the enemy has inflicted on these innocent civilians. And third and finally, the hope that this child sees at the expression of finally someone in power expressing anger at what's happened to him and the people he loves. And it's an amazing moment just to stop and think about these three moments, about how the expression of anger can produce really the whole spectrum of emotions in the person who perceives it. And to think about, as we look at these sources, which mode of anger we're seeing, both in the people who are enacting it and in the people who are seeing it and are its objects. Okay, so this is a chance for any questions before we jump into our first main source, which is from the Talmud. Okay, great. This is a very detailed discussion, and I'm going to give two pieces of background which will make it somewhat easier to make it through. The first, we're in the Masechet Shabbat, we're dealing with the laws of Shabbat, and specifically, the laws of Shabbat I'm going to frame for the moment in the following way. The central prohibition on Shabbat is what was called Melechet Machshevet, intended work for a purpose, right? That the main thing one is supposed to refrain from on Shabbat is not the alteration of the physical world in some kind of basic physical sense. It's the advancement of human aims which happen to involve and require the transformation of the physical world. That's the core concern, which raises the interesting secondary question, which this mission is going to get to. What about destroying the world? Is destroying the world as bad as building up the world on Shabbat? And we'll see that the answer, according to the Mishnah, is no. That's the first kind of thing to keep in the background. The second piece of background, which is related to that, is that there's a debate between two figures in the earliest stratum of sages we have, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, about how to relate to an act that a person undertakes, not for the sake of the physical act itself, i.e. what people normally want from it, but for some other kind of more abstract, normally not intended consequence. This category is called Melacha She'ena Tzricha Legufa. And there are many standard examples. The one that I'll use for the moment is there's some bad folks out at night, prowling around the neighborhood, and you want it to look like nobody is at home, but you have this light burning in the window, and it's Friday night. So normally, the kind of core act of putting out a light is putting out the light in order to preserve the wick and the fuel, right? It's actually this kind of environmental image of you're basically concerned with a physical object and of transforming it. However, you, as the person in the house, don't actually care about this light. What you want to do is for the people who are out there not to see you. That's your goal. And so when you put out this light, you are now in the category of Melacha She'ena Tzricha Legufa, right? Because you're not doing it for the sake of putting out this light itself, but for some other kind of more amorphous, distant consequence. which is what you care about. And Rabbi Yehuda thinks that despite having a kind of more abstract intention, you are still liable for breaking Shabbat when you have done this act, whereas Rabbi Shimon thinks that since you didn't want the physical action itself to take place, you are not liable for breaking Shabbat, that this is actually not considered a change of the world directly. Okay, those are two pieces of background. The third piece of background we need is the tradition that, which is a halakha, that when one loses a close family member, one is obligated to rend one's garments in mourning as a kind of making, and some kind of expression of making one's outside state more like one's inside state, of being kind of broken in an irreparable way. Okay. Now, with those three pieces, we're going to move forward, and I just want to offer an invitation, given these three frames of anger that we've just felt, to, as you're learning this material, to see if you feel any of these sources of anger towards any one in the sugya, and if you do, to please consider sharing it. Here we go. From the Mishnah. A person who tears his clothes in anger, or for his dead relative, and anyone who destroys anything, are not liable. Right? Destruction does not count as the core area of breaking Shabbat. But a person who destroys in order to improve is according to the standard of a person who improves. Now that last sentence is a little opaque. What it means is, let's say you have a seam on a piece of clothing which is not properly made, and you tear it out in order to re-sew it. You are evaluated there. If you tear the amount that would make you liable were you to sew it, you are liable as well. We're not going to kind of address that last line, but we're reinscribing everything here in terms of what your ultimate purpose is. Now, the Gemara quotes a source which is contradictory to the first part of the Mishnah. Contrast this Mishnah with the following source. A person who tears his clothes in anger, or in grief, or for his dead relative, is liable. And even though he has profaned Shabbat, he has fulfilled his obligation to tear, right? This is actually the kind of final piece is the most important line. You've done a productive action. You fulfill the obligation to tear your clothing, and that's why you're considered as breaking Shabbat. It's this almost kind of paradoxical moment. By doing one good thing, you incur this other bad thing at the same time. And the Gemara goes on now in the ellipsis to resolve the contradiction between the two sources of mourning, and it actually ends up developing this extremely nuanced and intentional and really, I would say, precise language of mourning and of proximity and of grief. And it's an extremely worthwhile source, but it's not our main focus tonight. So we pick up after that those two sources have been resolved, and those pieces, and now we say still the two sources about anger contradict. The Gemara says, no, their positions on anger are not contradictory. The second source, which says a person who tears his clothing in anger is liable, follows Rabbi Yehuda, who says that a person is liable for a creative act not done for itself. Melacha she'ena tzricha begufa. But the Mishnah, which says a person who tears his clothing in anger is not liable, follows Rabbi Shimon, who says that a person is not liable for creative act not done for itself. Everything is nice and resolved. We have two different underlying theories of Shabbat, nothing more to be said. But the Gemara is not willing to leave things here. It objects, I could say that you heard Rabbi Yehuda's position in the context of improvement. But have you ever heard Rabbi Yehuda state his position in the context of destruction? Now, what the Gemara means by this is we have, go back to the image I gave of the core problem being improving physical labor to the world. You take one step outside of that, in the umbra of that concern, when you are talking about destruction, and then you take a second step outside of it when you're talking about melacha she'ena tzricha begufa, which has a more abstract purpose. What the Gemara is asking is it really plausible that Rabbi Yehuda would say that two steps removed from the central concerns of Shabbat, you're still liable for breaking it? And the implicit answer, the Gemara is going to say no. So it's going to have to come up with a reason now how tearing one's garments out of rage, which might have been a better translation than anger here, is a constructive act. That's where we're headed, and that's where the whole sugya will lead us. So Rav Avin gives us our first answer. This, too, is improvement, for he pacifies his urge. Which is a striking statement, right? That what we're thinking now, not on the physical level of the garment, which is ruined, but on some kind of subjective level, that the world is a better place for this person because of this cathartic kind of venting of their anger through their clothing. And I always like to think at that moment, what were the kind of other options that this person had with their anger? Was it possible for them to keep it in? Would it have was it directed at a specific person? There's a whole kind of world here. And one of the striking things about this sugya is that we never, ever know what the reason for someone's anger is, right? That's a kind of a question that's not addressed. It's left for us to wonder, and I think there might actually be something significant there, that as viewers of one another's anger, it's oftentimes the thing that's most hidden from us is the event that sparked it. Now watch what the Gemara does to Rabbi Avin's answer. It's going to knock it down and say that that was not a constructive act to vent one's anger by tearing your clothes. But is such a thing permitted? Do we not have a tradition of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, who spoke in the name of Hilpa bar Agra, who spoke in the name of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nori, as follows? A person who tears his clothes in anger, or who smashes his possession in anger, or throws away his money in anger, you should view that person as if he were worshipping idols. For this is the design of the evil urge. Today it says do this, and tomorrow it says do that, until eventually it says worship idols, and he will go and worship idols. Now, I want to pause here for a moment because there's a few really striking things have been laid out in this. First, just on a technical level, a progression has been laid out that essentially kind of giving in to one's evil urge is the slippery slope, right? There isn't a slipperier slope than this. It kind of slowly, slowly strengthens in you, and eventually you lose any control of orienting your life and directing it to your most important values. And in that sense, we've turned the tables, and now this tearing of the clothing is actually an act of destruction, but an act of self-destruction now, not an act of repairing one's world. The second thing, which I think is important to point out here, is anger is seen in this position not as kind of particularly dangerous in the moment. Right? It's not like you might do something right then that you'll regret out of anger. You might say something you can never take back. But it's kind of taking a long view. It's like over many, many years, like something will change inside you, and you'll slowly think it's okay to do more and more things. You'll slowly think you need to do more and more things that are further and further away from the kind of person you once recognized as yourself. And the third thing is, I think that the most interesting feature of this statement is that this is not a statement which is posed as follows, which is how it normally would be in most places in the Talmud. If you feel your anger telling you to do something, you should not listen to it. Because if you listen to it today, and you'll listen to it tomorrow, and eventually you will come to worship idols. Rather, the statement is actually directed to the person who's the witness of the anger. Right? The anger is a social reality, and it says how to regard this person. And this is kind of a cool Norman Schwarzkopf. How I would describe this statement, right? It's saying, this person, it's not you're supposed to be angry at them, but you should have this kind of distance and suspicion. And at this moment, I think we're all kind of implicated in this passage, both as the people who perceive anger and the people who are angry. And I just want to put that out there, that we're somehow kind of all being tried here. And now Rav Avin is going to amplify this and really raise the stakes in a dramatic way. He says, what verse teaches this? This idea of the incrementally dangerous Yetzer Hara, the evil urge of anger. The quote from the book of Psalms, there shall be among, but literally within you, no foreign god, nor shall you bow to any strange god. What is the foreign god within a person? It is the evil urge. So the idea here is that it's a progression in the verse, right? There's a foreign god within a person, and eventually they come to bow to that god. And that is the progression laid out in the verse in Psalms, is also a course of life that's charted out by a person who follows this. And now, what's happened is we've kind of laid to rest the first Rav Avin. And the question I want you all to keep in mind, especially if you're interested in looking at the source in depth, is how Rav Avin could have said both of these things. Because it seems like on the one hand, Rav Avin is setting up a position where cathartic tearing of one's clothes is an improvement of one's state, and also that it's an act, essentially, of idolatry. Those two are not so easy to reconcile, but I'll offer kind of one small step in that direction in a few minutes. But now we're back to square one in terms of the flow of this piece of Talmud, that there's no constructive purpose that we've been able to identify for the tearing of one's clothing in anger, and therefore there's no reason to see a person as liable for having done it. And now the sugya will answer this problem by giving a constructive teleology. It says, we need the second teaching, that one is liable for tearing in anger on Shabbat, only for one who acts in order to impress fear on the members of his household. Like Rav Yehuda, who tore the hem off of his garment, Rav Acha bar Yaakov, who broke broken dishes, and Rav Sheshet, who threw brine at his maidservant's head. Now, there's a lot to be said here. I see Bethany kind of slowly exhaling. So the first is we have arrived at a constructive purpose, like a valid purpose for expressing anger, which is to scare other people. Which is not, I bet most of you weren't expecting that to be where we ended up. And there's more to say on that. We'll bring two sources which will give some important context to that in a second. But I want to say some things on the emotional plane of this, these three examples first. There's something extremely graphic about this example, especially the third one of this woman. I mean, just imagine this gross, sticky, smelly brine being launched at her, actually by the blind Rav Sheshet, which I think gives this other kind of image to the story. And I think a small piece of what's going on in this sugya is that these three examples are increasingly violent. Right? There's the tearing of a kind of sewn-on hem, there's the smashing of something, and then there's this kind of assault. And I think that what's going on in the course of those examples is basically the progression in the story, the progression we saw before of one slowly losing control of oneself in an engagement with anger, and kind of in failed engagements with anger, is actually being played out step by step over the course of these three people's outbreaks. And I also just want to say that in the context of, I don't know how many of you have been following this, but the stories, the allegations that are up kind of circling in the Jewish world right now about Ravina in Israel, it's particularly poignant to read about, you know, these kinds of questionable or contested acts of anger in private that are meant to impress fear. It's particularly timely and haunting. And if people have questions or want to discuss that further, I would be happy to. The third thing I want to say about this last piece is I think, yeah.
I'm sorry, I feel like I just didn't understand the paragraph.
In this text?
This one right here.
Okay, can you say what you did not understand about it?
So when I read it, what I hear is that we have this restriction on Shabbat in order to keep these people from doing these angry things.
Ah. I see.
Towards there, that they have a tendency to do these angry things, and so we say that they should be a bunch of us.
I see. So that.
I guess I'm not understanding.
Right. So. That on a conceptual level, that read would lead you to a place of it's fine to do these things the other 6 days of the week, which would be
right. We don't really want them doing them, but.
Right. So the work that this last paragraph is doing is that imposing this kind of fear on the people around you and maybe the people who are strictly lower than you in this kind of social hierarchy is a good thing. And it requires, in all of these cases, something. I don't think that these stories happened on Shabbat. But had they happened on Shabbat, these rabbis would have been chayav, even according to the Yehuda, because they had done this constructive act.
Oh, it was a constructive act.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Part of what I want to put on the table here is I think that different people in this room identify with different people in the story. I imagine when I first read this story, I strongly identified with the maidservant. And I think that it's probably impossible to read this story without reliving on some level moments when powerful people have been angry at us and moments when we've been angry at people and scared about our own power. And that kind of the fear on both sides of that relationship is very, very real. Now, the last thing I want to say about this is, are you raising your hand? Yeah. Oh, wow.
So there's almost an opposite point of view about how we need to be honest about the reaction to the other person and then be honest about theirs.
Great. Great. So I want to take this idea, because what you're saying, which is a striking thing up to this point in the sugya, is that there's kind of, unlike Martha Nussbaum via Elie Wiesel, the Talmud hasn't really said anything in favor of anger, or this last piece is as close as it's come, right? It's just told us that there's something valuable about it. And I want to highlight, before we get into some sources, which will say something a little bit clearer, and it won't get to quite the level of allowing this kind of, you know, real reconciliation like you're describing, but we'll get to something close to it, that something radical happens in the Talmud with the introduction of these last three stories in this last paragraph. And that is, until this point, anger is basically called the evil urge. Consistently through the sugya, and even more than that, the evil urge is the nicest thing that anger is called, right? Rav Avin is the first person to speak to this specific issue. He says, right, this is his urge, right? That's the evil inclination, just kind of demonic presence within oneself. And then this tradition of a person about eventually worshipping idols continues, this idea that it is the evil inclination that is pushing you to act this way. And then Rav Avin just comes and raises the stakes by calling it idolatry. But there's this basic sense, if you were to take those first statements and really derive something from them, it'd be like, unfortunately, you and I and every human being is a being that gets angry. And just know when you see that what it is, right? It's about the most dangerous, worst thing in the world. And like, stay as far away from it as you can, right? It may be clear on the outside who true and untrue gods are, but it's on the inside, you should know, we want to identify this for you, stay away from your own anger. And then all of a sudden, something switches in the last section. Right? In two basic ways. First of all, we don't see anger as a presence inside a person, necessarily. Anger is something that happens between people. It's acted out here not in terms of primarily a need to unleash something, a need of this kind of built-up desire that calls for destructive action, but it's actually basically an interpersonal reality, and it's seen as serving an important goal. And I want to look on with you about what that goal might be. So turn with me to the next page. We're going to look at two sources which relate to this. The first is Rav Yehuda, and this is the very same... I'll take your questions, but I just want to kind of put these two sources for some context, and I'll take your question, Josh. The first is Rav Yehuda. This is the same Rav Yehuda who tore the hem off of his garment in anger we saw a minute ago. He said in the name of his teacher, Rav, a person who creates excessive fear within his home will eventually come to three sins: sexual abomination, spilling of blood, and desecration of Shabbat. Now, we've already seen desecration of Shabbat as a question in our sugya. And now we have a sense, and this really kind of tightens it in an important way, that anger is this deeply double-edged sword. And I want you to kind of think back to the Elie Wiesel story. You can imagine someone who is now trying to create the right amount of expression of anger and of fear. People, a sense of fear of the sacred, fear of what is valuable, fear maybe to keep people away from doing dangerous things or cruel things to one another, and who oversteps those bounds. Ultimately, what happens is it's a self-destructive act, or it's a self-destructive process that one unleashes. But again, here we have a statement that focuses much more on excessive fear and tells us nothing about the kind of, if there's some kind of like sweet spot of fear and anger, which I realize even saying that sounds so strange because the images are so dissonant. And so I just want to offer what I think is the clearest statement of this, which is a beautiful and important source in its own right, but especially significant here. This is from Shabbat 54b. A person who is able to prevent the members of his household from transgressing but does not prevent them is caught, i.e. is seen as liable, is drawn into the transgressions of the members of his household. And the same is true. The person who can prevent the members of his city is caught for the members of his city, and the person who can prevent the entire world is caught for the entire world. This is about as clear a statement as you can get about really trying to lay out some sense of collective responsibility for other people's actions. And I think it offers a window into what each of these rabbis, Rav Yehuda, Rav Acha Bar Yaakov, and Rav Sheshet, is trying to do in their household, that there's a sense of a responsibility to a certain sense of, and now you can answer one of two ways, either to a sense of sacred and an ideal, or actually to the other people in the household, that they feel a responsibility towards them to exert a certain kind of expression, a certain sense of honesty, and a certain sense of imparting what their values are, and that that's ultimately more important, and maybe even require a sense of fear and some kind of exchange of anger, which is now a whole different picture of what it looks like to be angry and what it looks like to look at someone who's angry. Okay, I've just put a lot on the table here working through this material, and so I want to take a few minutes for people's reactions and comments. Josh.
Going back to the terrifying triplet of reactions of the actions of the rabbis from the end of the sugya on page 2. Mm-hmm. Seems to me most striking about this is in terms of these are actions that said explicitly that they're tumorous fear, or another way of putting it is threatening people. Either they're trying to display violence or the possibility of violence against people to inspire some kind of change in their actions. But I think what specifically is interesting in terms of the way anger manifests is the way that it not only bubbles out from you, but actually the part of the point of it, part of the result of it, is to blur the comfortable, the safety barrier between two people. When he, I mean, we see all this breaking images or shattering images or dissolution images, and I think that speaks to the emotional reality of when one expresses anger, at least in this very violent way, you know, ripping the garment or smashing dishes or actually just acting in an interpersonally violent way, but all these are acts of violence, one's manifesting the threat or the fear of this violence might happen again. You actually can't rely on me. I'm not a safe person to be around. And that, in that kind of, that the fear that that engenders is what's supposed to encourage that behavior.
Okay, do people have reactions to what Josh said or other material here? Yeah, Catherine.
Josh alluded to something I noticed, which is the escalation in these three images from Rabbi Huda doing something that is violent but essentially sort of self-destructive or not directly threatening to anyone around him, whereas breaking dishes seems to be something that's not directed at the dishes, but broken dishes sort of more immediately threatens violence toward another person, to Rabbi Shisha actually assaulting another person.
The thing that makes the Elie Wiesel story read a little bit like a fairy tale is, like, I mean, think how many, like, bombings and shooting are going on around that story. Like, it's a nice story because, like, the black officer doesn't have to, like, pull out a gun and shoot someone in the court who's, like, trying to assault Elie Wiesel. Right? There's a whole kind of surrounding of violence that's happening in that story. And the people, I mean, on some level we can, you know, if we try to play out the cash value of what this child, Elie Wiesel, is feeling, he's like, you know, thank God now those people who are terrifying me have someone bigger to be scared of, who will stop them. And that, I think, is part of, and that can make you go in one of two directions. You can be like, wow, either like, Elie Wiesel had like a totally understandable reaction of a child in this situation, and it's not something that I want to inform my moral intuitions or our moral intuitions as an adult. Or you can say, wow, like Elie Wiesel was like really onto something in that moment as a child that we need to hold on to, and even at the cost of broadening that image to the whole, you know, kind of advancing Allied army in Germany. Yeah, Bethany. I think it's a great point, and I want to, yeah, Dina, the last comment.
I just was wondering if you gave any thought to that the three sins in the Gitin Pastor is on page 3, right? Instead of being the big three, right, worshipping idols is replaced with Chilul Shabbat, and it's sort of in a source in Shabbat about Chilul Shabbat.
Includes worshipping idols.
And I was wondering if you had,
yeah.
Like,
my thought is that there's something there, and I'm not sure exactly what it is. I want to offer, and this is kind of the, I think, both the most accurate read and the most sympathetic read I can give of these sources, because I think Josh brought up a really critical distinction. The key kind of line that's drawn in these sources about anger seems to be the distinction between a right amount of fear that we experience and a excessive amount of fear. And I want to suggest that what that's actually not just a quantitative distinction, but what it is the excessive amount of fear is exactly what Jess says. I am not a person you can trust. I kind of am a dangerous person, at least some of the time, if not much of the time. And the kind of amount of fear that's being described as some kind of ideal even is a sense of, on these terms, which you control, right, if under these behaviors, if you, you know, kind of act in this good and upstanding way, I will basically be your ally and support you. And when you cross that line, I will then begin to kind of communicate my displeasure, upset, etc., in a way maybe that Yosef did not. But for there to be a sense of clarity and basically of safety and boundaries. Okay. Now, I hadn't really thought in preparing this about how difficult this pivot would be. Kind of like not just an emotional 180, but really traveling from one pole to the other. Anya, were you going to say something?
I just wanted to add on what you just said, that the other extreme is no emotion at all. And for me, that's what Eli Wiesel is talking about here. It's like people are sometimes so overloaded with emotion that we shut down and we don't have emotion. And how wonderful it is when you see someone who has went through a trauma or has gone through something very terrible in their life and they shut down. And then when they first express, I'm actually really mad at that person. They really hurt me. They start to get angry. That's actually life again. They've actually started to unpack the emotion. And maybe this isn't exactly what's going on with Eli Wiesel, but for me, it's like a child seeing like emotion, lack of emotion, complete lack, and then, wow, the world is waking up. The world just has emotions again. The world is seeing the injustice and is able to respond.
It's very nice. I mean, it's totally like what Miriam was saying about there's a contrast not just between different emotions, but also between like a kind of bleakness and a fullness. Okay, we're going to kind of pivot here and turn. We're going to move about 1,000 years and a few thousand miles. The next two passages we're going to read are from a man who was probably solidly the contender for the greatest Jewish philosopher of the Middle Ages and the clear champion of the most underappreciated Jewish philosopher of the Middle Ages, which is a man named Christi Crescas. He grew up and lived most of his life in Barcelona. And he lived through some kind of terrible times for Spanish Jewry. And he is known in posterity basically as the greatest Jewish intellectual opponent of the Rambam that ever lived. And we'll see a piece of that where he will basically take up the issue of joy as both a theme to be developed on its own and a club with which to beat the Rambam and his followers, to use the images that we're working with here. And I just want to give you kind of one piece of background, which is important to know, that there's this idea which comes in a circuitous way via Aristotle, but becomes, you'll see it in most chapters of the Guide of the Perplexed, that God is the unity of, and I'm going to say three things which probably you think can't be one, but you're about to find out that maybe they could, the understander, or the comprehender, kind of a thinker who comprehends something, the comprehended, the object that's thought about, and the comprehension itself, that kind of abstract link between them. Okay, so imagine like I'm here, that chair is right there, and then somewhere, maybe in my brain, maybe in like the world of the forms, is my understanding of that chair. And now try to imagine all of us being one, basically, because I actually contain the chair inside me, and I contain all knowledge inside me, and you'll start to have a window into what God is for people like Rome. It's this kind of totally encompassing and totally understanding and totally integrated being, integrated to the point of like total oneness in this way that we really can't totally grasp. And now this means that, among other things, God doesn't change a lot. And God doesn't kind of feel a lot or get excited a lot, which then produces a number of problems when you try to work with a book like the Bible and or a tradition like the Talmud. And so what happens, as often happens, is these kind of large-scale philosophical debates get centered around specific verses and ideas, and they're batted back and forth. And so what Christi Crescas is going to do is going to pick up two of these sources, which are kind of interpreted allegorically in some of the super rationalist people, and say that the Rambam and his followers, and say that they've misinterpreted them. So the first is this source, the introductory blessing for a wedding meal, which many of you will be familiar with, right? Baruch Elokeinu she'simcha b'mo'ono v'she'achanu mishalo u'v'tuvo chayinu. And it's that addition which I bolded there, she'simcha b'mo'ono, the joy somehow resides with God, which is going to be the central point of the debate. And the second is another attribution of joy to God, yichvod Hashem le'olam yismach Hashem b'ma'asav, that God rejoices in God's works. Okay, so that's the background, and now we're going to jump right in. And so if someone would be willing to read, and I'll kind of interrupt you at the end of each paragraph and offer a running commentary. Matt, take it away.
We should now investigate a concept attributed to God, may God be blessed, in the words of the prophets and our sages of blessed memory, joy, simchah. Even in the writings of the Bible, it says, God shall rejoice in God's works. And be it in the words of our sages of blessed memory, in the formulation of the blessing, in whose abode is joy. This, the attribution of joy to God, is common in the biblical and rabbinic interpretation.
We just made the case, God has a lot of joy. You can't just try to ignore this. Now he's going to say what this means.
I will state the basic claim of Aristotle and of those who follow him here. Comprehension, asaga, is satisfying arev, the one who comprehends. And the greater yoter nikbad, the object which is comprehended, the greater the satisfaction and joy. God, may God be blessed, comprehends everything in the greatest possible way. Therefore, it must be that God has the greatest possible satisfaction and joy.
Okay, so I just want to summarize that for you, right? There's nothing better than understanding things. You may have disagreed, but you were wrong. God understands things as well as possible. Therefore, no one could be happier than God. Okay? That's what, according to the Rambam, what all these attributions of joy to God mean. Okay.
However, this claim clearly fails, as will be seen, for two reasons. First, joy is nothing other than the satisfaction of a desire. It is, in effect, hipaldut within the soul. Therefore, granted that we feel joy when we comprehend something, this is due to the fact that we have a soul that desires. But a being who is the unity of comprehender, comprehended, and comprehension, the Aristotelian consensus regarding God, and does not possess a desiring soul, joy and satisfaction could not be ascribed to such a being.
Okay, so the first claim, which is an extremely strong claim, is Kreskes says, if you want to talk about joy, you have to talk about desires. Because unless you want things, you won't be joyful when you have them, when you gain them. And so therefore, the Maimonidean God that just has knowledge and no desires can't be a joyful God because, and here's the kind of basic idea that we're going to develop more, that really what we care about when we care about, when we're happy about knowing things is not that we know things themselves, it's that we desire to know things and that desire is fulfilled. But that's part number one.
Second, granted that satisfaction can be attributed to God, it would not happen in the manner described through comprehension. That is, it is improper to link our comprehension to God's at all. For the satisfaction we have in comprehending something occurs when we transform our comprehension from potential into actual. This is why when we acquire any new knowledge which was previously hidden from us, we feel, nitfael, joy in our sudden emergence from ignorance into knowledge.
Okay, and now Kreskes is going to give three proofs for this, and to really kind of understand these, I think the most helpful frame of mind is to go back to the time when you learned something, and you were like so happy that you learned it. You're just like, the world opened up, you wanted to tell everyone about it, you didn't really want to leave the place where you'd figured it out, because you had just like that really good feeling there, you like have a nice feeling whenever you look at the book that you were reading on the shelf, like kind of get back into that headspace, and he's going to now just give a really kind of rich phenomenology of why and how it's lovely to learn things.
This is demonstrated by the fact that our joy is greatest at the initial moment of comprehension, while after we've comprehended something the first time, the satisfaction weakens a great deal.
Okay, right, now go back and think about just the thing that you learned at that moment, right? I would wager that most of you do not feel nearly the same level. It's the memory that's sweet, actually, but not the knowledge itself. That's point number one. Keep going.
Another demonstration of this is that the deeper the comprehended matter is, the greater the satisfaction. This is so true that in comprehending a shallow, abstract concept, we achieve, masik, less satisfaction than with a deep concept, even if the latter is less abstract.
Okay, this was a little bit difficult. What Kreskes is saying is that the joy that we feel in understanding something is not just about the cognitive act of how hard it was to grasp it. It's about how significant it was in your life, right? That he actually uses language of deep, just like we use today. He says amok in the Hebrew, right? The things that I think all of you remembered back to were things of real significance. They weren't, and the reason that you were excited about them is because they matter in your life, not just because it was really, really hard and it was like an LSAT problem where you have to hold all these complicated things or like a hard sugya that was just abstract. It actually kind of touched your soul, and that's the source of the joy.
In inescapable demonstration of the truth of this comes from the fact that we achieve no satisfaction in comprehending obvious principles. We spell every single note.
This is like principles like 2 plus 2 equals 4 or something. I mean, that's less obvious than what I'm talking about. You can't believe a thing and its opposite. They can't be something like that. It's just like necessary, it's clear, it's like the basis of everything.
Because of this, it is incorrect to link our satisfaction from comprehension, which is caused by our emergence from ignorance into knowledge of the first moment of comprehension, to the comprehension of one from whom every concept is always already an obvious principle without emergence, change, or first moment of comprehension. For this reason, it is clear that one cannot attribute satisfaction to God in this Aristotle's way.
So the last point is he's saying that, is Crescas is saying that for God, everything is obvious, and God always knew everything. So there's never that moment of first recognition, and there's never that sense of having become more complete through learning something, because everything is just on such a lower level than God. So now that's the sense. So Crescas has said, okay, first of all, we're attributing God happiness to God. That means God must have desires. Second, he said that happiness can't come from God's knowledge. Now I want you to think about that verse, Yismach Hashem b'ma'asav, right, that God's works are somehow important, because that's the direction we're going to go now. So keep going, Ned.
It has been demonstrated beyond any doubt that God, acting with purpose and desire, Kavanah v'Ratzon, is the true cause of all existence, and that God is the one who causes existence to endure through the continuous flowing forth of God's goodness. This is expressed in the established blessing to the one who daily renews in goodness the work of creation. Therefore, since God causes goodness and fullness to flow forth purposefully and in accord with God's desires, it must be that God loves doing good, ahatavah, and the flowing forth of goodness. This is love, which goes beyond the satisfaction of desire, and this is true joy. The verse, God shall rejoice in God's works, means that God's joy is in God's works, which are the flowing forth of goodness to existence, causing existence to endure in the most whole way.
Okay, so this is really where Crescas starts to open up a picture of kind of who God is. And the basic claim is that God, we see that God gives great goodness to people and is kind of constantly offering us the greatest gift, which is life and existence. And Crescas says, okay, that must mean that God deeply desires that we live and that we flourish. And that's actually what love is. Love is the desire that another being exist and flourish. And God, therefore, must love us a great deal. And that the joy that God gets from the world is in that love. Yismach Hashem b'ma'asav. We are God's works. And in continually reframing us and forming us and reforming us is where God takes joy, not kind of in God's head, if you can say such a thing. Okay. And now he's going to take this home. He's going to go on a little digression. Actually, we'll skip the next paragraph for the purpose of time. But he says God might even hunger for such things. And now just read the last paragraph of this section.
Now we can understand the blessing in whose abode is joy. In its plain sense, since the joy of a wedding is shared by the blessed Creator, flowing forth of divine goodness, and by the creatures in receiving this flowing forth. This is the statement that the truest joy is in God's abode, i.e. in God's presence.
Okay, so this is where Crescas really hits it out of the park, I think. So what he's saying, he's giving this picture of the wedding as really like the truest meeting point of God and human beings, right? It's like you thought it might have been the Beit Midrash, or maybe Shul, or maybe, you know, pick your mitzvah. It's actually the wedding. And the reason is because this is the truest flourishing of a human being that can happen, is in this moment. And that's where the human being kind of is most fully open and most fully receiving God's great goodness. And that's really a shared joy. I mean, it's this, if we think for a moment, we've talked a lot about what anger looks like to someone on the other side and this experience of fear. And now we have a different picture of joy as this meeting point of human beings and God. And the thing that I think is actually most subtly radical in our context about the language of joy here that Crescas is using is that I am used to the kind of joy in religious context being deployed in the following way. It's like, what it means to be religious, like, Baruch Hashem Ani Noshem. It's like, is to be grateful for everything. It's like, you know, Josh has even written about this recently. It's like, that parking lot out there, that's God's presence. It's like, you should just love every piece of trash between here and the 72nd Street subway station because it's all beautiful overflowing of God's goodness. And that is not what he is saying. This is an extremely discriminating sense of joy that we have here, right? So actually weddings are different than walking to the subway station. And human flourishing is something different. And joy comes actually when we have deep desires that we fulfill. And in the transition, the sense of growing, right, that sense of acquiring new knowledge, he doesn't say you should actually feel joy about all the things you've ever learned in your life, and it's your fault if you're having trouble feeling joy or remembering them. He's actually, no, you can't really feel joy unless you are moving closer to realizing the things that are most important to you. And it's in that sense that joy is discriminating in the best sense of that word here, that it actually teaches you something about what's important to you as a being, and also it seems teaches us something important about what is important to God. Yeah, Molly.
I guess one thing that distinguishes this particular Jewish philosophy then is that we're supposed to desire, because only then can we have the joy.
Exactly. Exactly. And only then can you actually... Right, God has big plans for us. And so we better have big plans for ourselves, basically, seems to be. And really try to care about them in the same way God does. This is kind of interesting. You could think about what the Lechet Bidracha, what some kind of Imitatio Dei would look like in this. Which are both vis-a-vis how we see ourselves and how we see other people and care for them. So this is one picture, and I want to kind of really offer this as an opportunity. I mean, there's something striking about, this is the first place, if people know of others, where really weddings are set up as the center for religious life. And to think about then, he talks about prayer also as an opportunity to achieve a kind of intimacy, which is God's plans for us. And I just want to open that up as a different window, I think a window we don't have so often into what it means to be Jewish. And this is, love, which I think is one that's close to human love in the best ways we experience, and joy that's full and real and seen as kind of valuable in its own right. And what we're going to do now for the next 10 minutes or so is look at one of the big payoffs of this kind of idea. And what I want to just frame it by doing is what the path that Kreskes led us on. It's actually a kind of amazing thing when you look at this literarily, the way he's done this, is we started off talking about God's knowledge. We started talking off about comprehension and what it's like to comprehend. And that then kind of is important, Kreskes said, because it offers us a window into joy. It offers us a portal into joy. And then we ended up with a full-blown discussion of what joy is and actually placing that at the center. Knowledge is really now important just because it's a way into joy, but not particularly more important than building a family of a certain kind or achieving a certain kind of intimacy in prayer. And that same kind of fundamental tension that Kreskes has drawn on here between placing intellectual achievement and perfection at the center versus placing a kind of emotional intensity and focus at the center is now going to play out. He's going to kind of take the take on the offensive here as he really goes to the center of what he thinks is the problem with the Maimonidean and Aristotelian worldview, which is the idea that there's a commandment to believe in God. So here's how he lays out his response to that idea. So who would like a last reader to take us home here? Yeah, Eric, go for it.
How could there be reward and punishment for beliefs relating to Torah? What would I give to understand this? For it is being clear in the tradition that our punishment is extraordinary. As they said, the heretics and Epicureans, those who deny the Torah or deny the resurrection of the dead, will remain in Gehinnom generation after generation. And the following have no share in the world to come. One who says that the resurrection of the dead is not found in the Torah, one who says that the Torah is not from heaven, and the Epicurean.
Okay. It's really bad not to believe the right things. Okay, in case you had any doubt about that before you came in, two nice source citations from the Talmud. Okay, we haven't gotten quite to the problem yet of why there can't be reward and punishment, but now he's going to lay that out extremely clearly.
But we can clearly see that desire and choice have no sway whatsoever in these matters, because when a person believes something, she expresses that belief.
She experiences it.
She experiences that belief as compelled and entirely unchosen.
So I just want to pause here for a second to notice what Kreskes has said, right? When you believe something, you experience that belief as compelled and entirely unchosen. No matter how hard I try, I am not going to believe that these chairs are any color other than orange. I'm not going to believe that I was actually created yesterday and all of my memories are fake. I mean, you can go on and on and on. There's a set of things that I believe, and I just, other than lying to myself, am not going to get anywhere in any other direction. And just to think about what that means, like there may be certain, it may be some basic things I can't change about myself. It can't be a mitzvah to be, you know, 9 feet tall, because like, or maybe, you know, 5 feet 6 inches tall, because like, some of you get that great, like I don't, other, most of us don't. Like he's saying the beliefs are basically in this area over which we have no control. Now what falls inside of that and outside of that, I think probably differs wildly in this room. You know, there are certain things we just like cannot change about how we see the world. And just to put that front and center. Okay, keep going.
How much more so when she has compelling, inescapable reasons irrefutably proving it to be true? In these situations, she feels clearly, perceptibly, and viscerally compelled to believe the result of the proof, and it is simply impossible for her to believe the opposite. For desire and choice have no effect on beliefs. Beliefs are not a matter of choice, and desire cannot act upon them.
Okay, I'm curious now what kind of belief. So this is the second thing is like, this may be true of many things, especially when you think it's proven, right? When you, like, everything in your worldview would kind of fall apart if this thing turned out not to be true. I mean, I remember just very, very clearly an earth science teacher I had pointing to the periodic table of elements and saying, if you tell me that the universe is 5,000 years old, none of this is true back here. Because all of this, you know, the dating is all based on radioactivity, which is all based on the table. Like, everything holds together. And you can't just kind of change your belief in one piece of it. And I'm curious, in terms of what kinds of beliefs people are thinking of, as Eric was reading this paragraph. What are these some like beliefs you feel like you have that you're like, wow, whether or not I wanted to change them, they're just kind of there and part of me. Yeah, Josh?
You know, like examples?
Of yeah.
This one is like, yeah, something that I mean, if you think about it for long enough, I look like a complete idiot. But I fundamentally believe that if people truly understood the impact of their actions on others, they would never do something wrong.
Uh-huh.
So, like, obviously, you know, it seems very naive, but it's something that's very core.
It's not going anywhere.
It's just the way I relate to people, the way I understand the world.
Okay, great. Thank you. Other ones? Yeah, Eric?
I think that no matter how hard I try, and I guess I don't try that hard, I can't believe in reward and punishment, divine reward and punishment.
In this world?
I always think in this world.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Neither did Maimonides, but that's a different for a different night. Other ones.
I found that even at the like pinnacle of my existential crisis, is that I couldn't give up the idea that that God loved me and was actively involved in the world.
I realize there's something very like intimate and personal about discussing these things.
Do you realize
it? No, I knew it going in. I felt like if I said it at the beginning, it'd only make it even more awkward. But now that a few of you have broken the ice, yeah, Molly.
That I mean, whether it's that's there's a reason that we're here, but just that there is some sort of sense to exist that is not just
that. I think kind of whatever you have in this box, there's something very, I felt a great sense of relief when I read this passage for the first time, because I felt like someone was finally telling me that there were like certain basic things that I didn't have to change about myself. Because simply because I couldn't. Okay? Now I want to, like, we're going to kind of take a minute, but I just want to, back in the frame of Crescas for a minute here, point out that now he's really, now the question he asks is, Vinny, how could there be reward and punishment for beliefs relating to the Torah is a terrific question. Like, how can there be reward and punishment for things which are simply outside of our control, right? It's like, you couldn't imagine anything less just. Okay, so Eric, take us home here with this last paragraph.
After establishing that desires have no influence on beliefs, and that all beliefs are experiences compelled upon those who believe them, we have no option other than to locate desire and choice for which one is rewarded and punished in an area connected to beliefs and adjacent.
So he says there must be something else that you have control of in your life which kind of relates to beliefs but isn't exactly them.
This area is the satisfaction and joy we have when God graces us with belief in God and the exertion we dedicate to arriving at a different. This is undoubtedly a matter of desire and choice. For you can immediately see that a belief can be true without a believer achieving an awakening of joy for believing. From this it is clear that the awakening of joy and dedication to examining the belief's truth are driven by desire and choice. And from this the question of reward and punishment is resolved.
Okay. Would someone venture to paraphrase and summarize what Crescas has just said here? Yeah, Ariel.
That you're not being rewarded or punished for what you believe, but rather for what you desire to believe or your disposition towards what you believe.
Yeah, what you desire to believe and your disposition towards what you believe. It's a great formulation, and I'll say a few different things that I think will help motivate this. The first is something I realized actually in a conversation I had with Nat earlier this year, which is I think that we often have like very childish, and I mean that in the worst sense of the word here, language for the way we talk about our beliefs, which is basically, I do believe this or I don't believe this. And in my experience, actually our relationships with our beliefs are much, the center of gravity of those is not whether we do or do not believe, but kind of how we feel about them. There are beliefs that I have questions about, there are beliefs that I'm in dialogue with, there are beliefs that I laugh at, there are beliefs that I really like wish very, very deeply that I could hold, but I'm beliefs that I'm scared that I'm incapable of changing, beliefs that I wish I could free myself of, beliefs that I am angry at because I wish think the universe would be a better place without them. I mean, you can kind of multiply this list. And I think that that's actually where most of us live most of the time. It matters a lot less in the course of one's life whether or not you believe in the resurrection of the dead than what that means to you. I mean, to give you an image of what that might look like, Nietzsche has this incredible line. He says, if there's an afterlife, I hope it's this, that you have to live your life over and over again. Right, and it's like this picture of like that could mean a million. That the idea that that should mean different things to each and every person, and we all could want or not want that afterlife, and we could be excited about it. We could have. I mean, I could imagine someone saying the belief that Josh just said, and being so proud of it. They could say, you know, the thing that I just like love most about life, and I want you all to know about me is that you can't shake my belief in like the goodness of people if we could just open our minds and hearts, right? And that could, or you can say like, wow, I'm like kind of embarrassed about that, or like you could imagine a million different things. And what Crescas is saying is that what matters ultimately is whether we kind of how we orient our lives around our beliefs right now. Because think back to what he said about joy before, right? That you can only really take joy in things that matter a lot to you. And that what he's asking us to do is actually to really care in like a very, very deep way about whether we have succeeded to the extent that we can in living a life of the mind and the soul that's in line with the kind of tradition that's been sketched out up to this point in the Torah and in the sages. And to take that as really one of the most important projects we have in our life and to really appreciate properly where we are on that. And that is really all God can and does ask of us as human beings. And it's really, I think, if I could just kind of take a step back now to frame this in terms of emotion, what's really happened here is we normally think of beliefs as cognitive statements. I do or don't believe that this is true. And what Crescas has said is actually really that is a marginal piece of what's happening here. What's really central is the way you orient your life project and as a consequence of that, the set of emotions that we experience. And you could even add, if you wanted to, the kinds of actions that are attendant on those emotions. Do we seek out places and people that will transform us in the ways that we think are most important to the extent of our capacities? That is a picture of what a believing life looks like to Christi Crescas, and a life in relationship with God, and a life that's really centered around honing in on and really deeply experiencing, and I would say even seeking out and caring about our own sense of joy and flourishing in a way that really understands that God is at this and the Torah are at the center of that project, but can not ask us to convince ourselves any other way otherwise, but to really trust the sense of joy that God has given us as an accurate barometer of where we're headed. I've said a lot over the last hour and a little bit, and we have a couple minutes left for people's reactions and questions, and I especially want you to take a minute as we're closing up here to think back to that memory you spoke about and heard about at the very beginning, and think about kind of where you would place that if you have kind of some new language for it, new questions about it, if there are other memories and ideas that are coming up here as we go through these kind of texts and transition out back into our lives. The floor is yours. Yeah, Dina?
One of the things that really struck me in the first selection of Prescott, where he talks about sort of the wedding being like this union where God is also present, it doesn't seem to, at least in the selection that we have, really articulate like why that is. And I was thinking that it might be a response to these sort of allegorical meanings of Shir HaShirim, which sort of, by making all of this romantic love be about comprehension, somehow it sort of totally flattened the image and sort of emptied it of sort of its real love-ness. And then in the second piece, it was able to really talk sort of passionately about comprehension, sort of like there's a thing that you have and what sort of valuable is what you do to make that yours. I think that was sort of a move where he like received those allegorical interpretations of the Song of Songs for me. So that's sort of an emotion that I experienced while I was writing.
Okay, thanks. All right, Elle, what are you going to say?
I was wondering if, like, at the beginning you laid out this way of usually relating to emotion, and then like, person, I was wondering if you like it seems like the texts about anger are mostly in the first camp and the ones about joy are mostly in the second camp, and I was wondering if you agreed with that and if you thought it could just be attributed to the fact that anger is like a negative emotion and joy is a positive emotion, so like great, that's the children human anger.
Yeah, I would say, I'm glad you brought that up because I forgot that line at the conclusion here, that the Talmud says clearly that excessive anger is something that is basically never to be trusted. I would actually just say never to be trusted. It's to be seen as evil and whatever the opposite of trusted is. You should be even more than suspect. It's like if it tells you to go left, you should go right. That kind of
distrust.
Yeah. You should really see anger as your enemy. I mean, that's the kind of excessive anger. And that there's a kind of more low-grade smoldering anger, which I think there's a difference of opinions in the Talmud about it. I think it weighs in on both sides. Now, the passage from Crescas, really, he just, like, puts his thumb down heavily on the, like, emotions are important and useful. And I actually, just for the sake of trying to make this passage a little bit more coherent, took out all the sections about etzev, however you translate that, pain, frustration, anger, which he says is true of God, is true of people, is true when your plans are frustrated and your desire is not realized. So he thinks that he's really in the emotions are substantive and significant camp. Now, I just want to add in one other thing because I'm very curious about it, and I've been thinking about it a lot in preparing these lectures. It is very hard to find a sustained kind of rich Talmudic discussion of joy or happiness. And it is, I could give you, I mean, between me and Dina, I bet we could give you 40 sugyot right now off the top of our head that are extremely, like, poignant depictions of pathos, pain, angst, loss, and doubt. And I don't know why that is. the Talmud kind of like leans so heavily. I mean, I just think when I think of the stories I know in my life that really just like kind of tear at your guts, almost all of them are from the Talmud. The other ones are from This American Life. I mean, it's like, that's not quite true. But there's something about the genres of literature and about the kind of mood of them, which is really significant. And I would just also say it's like something to kind of notice as you're learning it, to see kind of where it's pulling you. Yeah, Josh.
This Kreskov's text is incredibly illuminating and very funny, and I think to read its validating side is really strong. I think a lot of us feel validated when reading this, like that what is inborn to us, what adheres within us, is something that is actually given to us by God, and that we need to, in a sense, learn how to trust ourselves and to relate to that. But part of it, but it's a real strong challenge and a painful challenge too, because it says that the joy we have when God graces us with a belief in God, the exertion we dedicate to arriving at this truth, that's the scale on which this is weighed. But what if we weren't born with that belief? And what if that's not under our control? Then what Kreskov is giving us is a life full of means to reject ourselves, actually, and strive actually towards the truth, even though we will never reach it.
Is he like asking me to be like, wake up every morning and be like, wow, at the top of my to-do list again today, I have, like, hope that I can believe in God. Probably won't work today either, but at least I feel bad about that. I think that is there, but I think that it's there. I think he would attack the problem in a kind of creative way, which is to say, like, I don't think he thinks that the problem is really, like, you know, I don't think he thinks the way to solve your kind of anxiety, doubts, whatever it is about God that you're trying to address is like in a head-on way. I think he's would have you actually focus on like the sources of joy in your life and on the realization that in achieving those, you are actually in a relationship with God in those moments. And really kind of, I think he would trust the kind of expansiveness of a feeling of joy at some point to be able to break open your picture of the world rather than just being like, that's not to say that he wouldn't want us to feel those things, like those reservations we have about our own lives, kind of question marks about the basic parts of our own lives. But I think that that's, again, I mean, it's interesting that you're bringing this up. I think we can frame that again in the level of, like, excessive fear, which is kind of, like, unstable and damaging and unpredictable versus, like, a sense of, like, actually the right amount of reservations we have to about the fundamental pieces of our lives and how we'd like them to change.
I really like to respond to that.
Please.
I see this as actually just depicting a situation similar to something like addiction, right? That part of the path of your life is going to be in the struggle against something that you feel like you cannot shake. It's not something that's ever going to really just like go away. And I think the joy element that you're bringing out is a very sensitive reading. That's one I actually haven't thought of. I think that's opening up a little bit. But I think I also want to also just make sure that like the pain, the challenge of that mode of life is—I think that is something he's laying down for someone, because it's not like you can't lapse into something that's ultimately—that's like that again. While it is inherent, isn't something that can be allowed to continue.
Okay, great. I want to leave that question open, because I think what it comes back to in a lot of ways is this question Miriam and Anya brought up of like, what's really at stake when you switch from a kind of emotionally flat plane of something like the Rambam's world into this like emotionally live world is like, you're not just going to be able to like play on the joy column all day. And that you should really like go into it with eyes wide open in that sense. And I thank you all for learning with me, and I'm looking forward to your thoughts and reactions going forward. A good evening.